Welcome to the September podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The September issue is on the topic of Chiari malformation and syringomyelia. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Mark Proctor of Harvard Medical School, Boston, speaks with Dr. Cormac Marr of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. They discuss Dr. Marr and colleagues' article, Chiari Malformation Associated with Craniosynostosis, which appears in this month's issue.
Welcome to this podcast for the September 2011 issue of Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Mark Proctor, one of the topic editors for this issue on Chiari Malformation. Chiari Malformation Type 1 is perhaps one of the more vexing and controversial topics in neurosurgery. There's a lack of agreement as to what defines a malformation, its symptoms, and its natural history. For a field as complex as neurosurgery, it's a bit ironic that there is such controversy regarding something which is on the surface such a simple topic. So why is it so difficult for us to wrap our heads around Chiari malformation? I think one of the main issues is that it's a very common incidental finding in the population. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Cormac Marr, who's an associate professor at the University of Michigan and who's an expert on the incidence of Chiari malformations. In this discussion, we're going to be highlighting his study in this month's Neurosurgical Focus on the incidence of Chiari malformation in patients with cranial synostosis.
Thanks very much for the invitation. In this focus submission, I tried to present the summary of patients that were evaluated at our institution for cranial synostosis over the last 15 years who also had the diagnosis of Chiari malformation. The fact that Chiari malformation is sometimes associated with cranial synostosis, of course, has been appreciated for decades. And we've seen Chiari malformation associated with both the syndromic as well as the non-syndromic types of cranial synostosis. So we reviewed the records of all of the cranial synostosis surgeries that have been carried out at our institution and found 383 consecutive patients over the last 15 years, 29 of which were diagnosed with Chiari malformation. Of those, 17 had Chiari malformation diagnosed prior to the cranial synostosis repair, and then interestingly, 12 were diagnosed following the cranial synostosis repair.
So, Dr. Marr, just following up on that, do you think that were these newly acquired Chiari malformations, or do you think they just hadn't been seen before the synostosis repair?
In some cases, they were newly acquired Chiari malformations and, in fact, had normal MRI scans of the brain, at least with respect to their tonsillar descent prior to the cranial synostosis repair, and then developed Chiari malformation at a 3.5-year mean interval to the development of Chiari malformation following the cranial synostosis repair. So that occurred in 5 of our 29 patients, and I think that's an interesting subgroup as part of the analysis.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you seem to find that certain types of synostosis were at higher risk for the development of Chiari malformation?
Absolutely. So lambdoid synostosis was definitely the highest risk for cranial synostosis being associated with Chiari. Now, of course, lambdoid synostosis is very rare. True lambdoid synostosis is very rare. It represented only 9 of our patients, but 5 of them had an associated Chiari malformation, at least by MR criteria. The other thing we found, which other authors have found in the past as well, is that multi-suture or syndromic synostosis is associated with Chiari malformation. But when we did a subgroup analysis of the multiple suture group, actually what we found is that, again, it comes down to the lambdoid suture being involved, where over half of those with multi-suture synostosis with lambdoid involvement had Chiari, whereas only 2 out of 19 of the multi-suture cases that did not have lambdoid involvement had Chiari. So even in the multi-suture cases, it still comes down to the lambdoid suture being involved in most cases. Now, there were isolated incidences of Chiari malformation with single suture cranial synostosis at other locations. We had, for instance, 5 out of our 183 sagittal synostosis patients had Chiari malformation, but that's a prevalence in that population of about 2.5%. So actually, that's not a very high prevalence of Chiari, even versus just other patients getting MRIs at our institution. The same goes for metopic synostosis. That has been reported that metopic can be associated with Chiari malformation. We didn't find that in our own series, where 0 out of our 71 patients with metopic synostosis had Chiari malformation. So really, the risk factor seems to be lambdoid synostosis, whether it's single suture or multi-suture synostosis.
Very interesting. So to sort of review, for say, sagittal or metopic synostosis, the incidence is almost that seen in the general population. But if you have a lambdoid suture fused, either or alone or as part of the multi-suture, you have a very high risk of having a Chiari malformation.
That's right. That's what we found.
And it seemed in the article that there were some other associations as well in the patients with a cranial synostosis and perhaps Chiari malformation.
Right. Just over half of our patients had hydrocephalus in the cranial synostosis and Chiari group. And over a quarter of those patients also had associated abnormalities of cerebral venous drainage.
And are these things that have been suggested in the past that might be contributing to the Chiari malformation developing in these patients?
Right. Other authors in the past have documented these associations with cranial synostosis and Chiari. And certainly it goes along with several of the theories right now for Chiari development in these patients. So one of these theories is that the skull remodeling itself leads to a decrease in posterior fossa volume, which in turn would lead to Chiari formation. And I think that this is very likely an important factor in Chiari malformation in these cases, as we could see by the incidence and the lambdoid synostosis. This is a theory which makes a lot of sense to me. Nevertheless, other etiologies that have been proposed have included some combination of hydrocephalus and venous hypertension. And I think, at least in some cases, that these might be important factors.
So to sort of review that, the few factors that seem causative might be the small posterior fossa, the hydrocephalus, and the venous hypertension may all contribute to some extent to the Chiari malformation.
That's right.
So what do you recommend once you see a patient with both a Chiari malformation and cranial synostosis? What's the management scheme?
Well, we had 17 patients who were diagnosed with Chiari prior to the cranial synostosis repair, and then the rest of our group, of course, were diagnosed following cranial synostosis repair. But of the 17 patients with the prior diagnosis, 10 had a Chiari decompression. 5 of these were done at the same time as the synostosis repair. And then I found this next group most interesting. We had 7 patients that had surgical repair of the cranial synostosis alone without any part of the surgical procedure specifically directed at the Chiari malformation. And of those 7 patients, 6 out of 7 had at least improved tonsillar herniation on follow-up imaging. And 2 of the patients that had syrinxes or syringes had a decreased syrinx size on follow-up imaging as well.
I was just wondering if you can expand on that a little bit. So when you did address the Chiari at the same time as the synostosis, was this all done through a bicoronal skin incision and a posterior expansion?
Exactly. Just reflecting the bicoronal incision posteriorly and then addressing the Chiari with a bone-only foramen magnum decompression through that exposure.
So through that same exposure.
Exactly.
Was it essentially an extension of your craniotomy for the Chiari repair?
Yes, for the cranial synostosis repair, exactly.
Exactly.
So I think in terms of recommendations, it's always a judgment call, and there's lots of different ways of approaching this issue. But at least based on these results of this relatively small group of patients, I think that for the milder manifestations of Chiari malformation, it would be reasonable to recommend cranial synostosis surgery alone, especially if your cranial synostosis operation was directed towards the lambdoid suture. And then to at least consider a simultaneous bone-only foramen magnum decompression for the cases that you're more concerned about.
Great. Let me ask you just a sort of a technical question there, Cormac. You know, a lot of these patients, as you mentioned, may have some venous hypertension, and now you're getting into the posterior fossa. Are you concerned about the degree of venous bleeding you may get in decompressing the foramen magnum?
Absolutely. And if there's a significant concern about that preoperatively, we've even ordered MRVs or CTVs. And if there's a very substantial venous abnormality that's going to prohibit foramen magnum decompression, we simply don't do it. The vast majority of these cases are asymptomatic, and in my opinion, it doesn't make sense to add risk to the operation when there's a significant venous channels.
Interesting. So who do you screen in general for Chiari malformation?
Well, I think that gets back to the matter of looking at relative frequencies of Chiari in certain groups of cranial synostosis patients. So, again, the lambdoid suture involvement, whether it's single suture or multiple suture, it would seem reasonable. For the same reason, because of the lambdoid suture involvement, Crouzon syndrome, it would seem reasonable. But I don't see any reason to screen any sagittal synostosis or metopic synostosis or even really coronal synostosis.
Interesting. And let me ask you, I know in my own institution these days, on a lot of the CAT scans with good coronal and sagittal reconstructions, we can actually detect Chiari malformations we couldn't see previously and would have to resort to MRI for. So do you think CAT scan is an adequate screening test if you can see that region well?
Absolutely. And I think you just said it, if you can see that region well. And it sounds like with your reconstructed views, you feel like you're getting an adequate view of the foramen magnum. So then if that's the case, I certainly wouldn't put the child through an additional screening test. Most of the children in our series had MRI scans. But you're right. Now that CT reconstructions are getting better, that may not be true going forward.
Great. So, Cormac, I know you've done some nice incidence studies looking at Chiari malformation, not just in this population, but in the general population. Can you tell us a little bit more just about some of your findings regarding the incidence of Chiari malformation in the population?
Sure. Well, we recently just looked at over 14,000 consecutive children that had brain MR imaging at our hospital for any reason. And of that group of about 14,000 children, we found 500 children, or just over 500 children, that had Chiari malformation by the 5-millimeter MR criterion. So that gives us a prevalence of about 3.5% in the population of children having imaging at our institution. And just under 1/4 of those patients had a associated spinal cord syrinx. So only about 32% of the patients that were diagnosed with Chiari were considered symptomatic by the treating physician at the time. And what that indicates to me is that the prevalence of asymptomatic Chiari is probably much higher than we had previously thought. And again, I think this is worth considering when we're making treatment decisions for children with a Chiari malformation that's discovered incidentally on imaging. And I think it can also be worth considering for issues such as the craniosynostosis issue. And again, if for example, we hear that there's a 2.5% prevalence of Chiari with sagittal synostosis, does that seem like a meaningful number or not? Well, based on what we're finding in the rest of our population, I would suggest that it's probably not.
Based on your numbers, having sagittal synostosis may be protective against Chiari malformation.
No, it's about the same. But you're right, it's a little bit less.
Good. And you found some age trends as well in that study, didn't you?
That's right. So we found that the imaging prevalence for Chiari didn't change much with advancing age. But what we did find was that the presence of a syrinx was predicted by advancing age. So that syringes were very rare in infants and very young children, but by about 4 or 5 years of age, they became significantly more likely, getting up to that 1/4 figure.
And in your group, was syrinx, did you consider that a symptomatic Chiari, or would you continue to observe a child with syrinx and Chiari?
There were very few children that were considered asymptomatic with a syrinx, but for our specific paper, as we described in the methods, we were defining symptoms according to neurological symptoms and defining syrinx separately.
I see.
But having said that, just like most groups, we have in the past been recommending surgery for children with asymptomatic syringes. I think, you know, that's something that we need to think long and hard about, whether that's going to continue to be the case in the future. But for the most part, we're recommending surgery for asymptomatic syringes.
Okay. Any other findings in your prevalence analysis that you'd like to discuss?
Yeah, there are a couple other findings. So with respect to gender, I thought it was interesting that girls were only slightly more likely to have a Chiari malformation than boys. But gender does matter in some other ways. For instance, girls were much more likely to have a spinal cord syrinx compared to boys. And also, interestingly, were much more likely to be considered symptomatic by the treating physician. So I think that the female preponderance that we're seeing in Chiari series isn't necessarily explained by the prevalence of Chiari in the general population being predominantly female, but certainly we're seeing more syringes and more symptoms, and I'm not sure why that is. Another finding that I thought was interesting was that with respect to tonsillar descent, it's more likely that we see a syrinx if we get more tonsillar descent, and this seems relatively logical. It has been suggested in the past that this was only true to a point, that there was a medium severity of tonsillar descent, sort of a sweet spot where we saw the largest percentage of syrinxes, and that if you went beyond that point with even more tonsillar descent, that somehow you would see fewer syrinxes. And we performed an analysis in our own group and didn't find that at all. Basically, the more descent you have, the more likely it is that you have a syrinx.
Mm-hmm. And you also did a natural history analysis of your group of Chiari patients.
Right. So we had 147 patients with Chiari that were basically recommended to not undergo surgery and for whom were followed with serial MR imaging as well as serial clinical exams. And the follow-up time for that was just over 4.5 years. All of the patients had been seen by a neurosurgeon. Again, the decision was made not to pursue surgery for these 147 patients. And over that follow-up interval, 9 patients did develop new symptoms. On average, patients younger than 6 years of age had a slight increase in tonsillar descent, and those older than 6 years of age had a slight decrease in tonsillar descent over time. But in terms of the mean descent, it wasn't very significant. To me, the most interesting thing wasn't examining the means, but looking for the outliers, and there were outliers in both directions. For instance, for a change in tonsillar herniation over time, we saw that most patients didn't change much on follow-up, but a few patients were significantly worse. And then most interestingly of all, and most surprising of all, a few patients were significantly better. And the same was true for syrinx size on follow-up. Again, most people were bunched in the middle, didn't change much over the follow-up time, but we did have outliers on both sides, patients that got significantly worse and patients that got significantly better.
Interesting. And both with the Chiari malformation, the tonsillar descent and the syrinx, were there any predictors, any advice you can give to people of which one might get better or worse?
We really didn't find anything for that. And again, in our group, we do tend to recommend surgery for patients with asymptomatic syringes. So this group in and of themselves were outliers for not having surgery.
Interesting. So it would seem your natural history analysis would reflect what recently came out of the group in Miami. Is that right?
Absolutely. So the Miami group just wrote a great article on the natural history of Chiari malformation. And in that article, they concluded that most, but not all, Chiari patients that are not considered surgical candidates don't progress, at least over, again, a relatively short time interval that we followed patients for as well. So I think our natural history analysis really mirrored their findings very nicely. So that was an excellent paper by the Miami group recently.
Yeah, I think we're just starting to learn more and more about the natural history of Chiari, and your work and the Miami group certainly contributed quite a bit in addition to the article out of Rome a few years back. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Marr. So in this issue of Neurosurgical Focus, we're going to try and clarify and provide some evidence addressing some of these questions in Chiari malformation and syringomyelia. The authors in the focus topic this month have addressed topics such as familial Chiari malformation, as we just saw, the association with synostosis and also other associated disorders, and the use of some newer imaging modalities that can help us establish the success of treatment of Chiari and syringomyelia. So we hope that these papers will help to bring our readers a degree of clarity regarding this somewhat complicated, simple condition.
Well, I really appreciate the invitation, and it's been fun. I do want to, before we go, acknowledge the hard work of my co-authors on some of these projects, including Jennifer Straley, who's a resident in our department, as well as Hugh Garten and Corinne Marasco, and Joey Kaperch as well.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Marr.
Thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the September issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the October issue, when the topic will be complications of spine surgery and management strategies. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.